All right, good morning. It is Thursday morning. It is March 18th, 9 a.m. We're doing Chem 12BL, and we're going to do a little bit more NMR stuff this morning. So I'm going to go ahead and start up a screen share, take it to the iPad. And this is going to be a little bit redundant, quite a bit redundant with lecture this afternoon, although we'll go farther in lecture than we will this morning. Frozen. Come on. There we go, better. All right, everybody can see what I'm doing. And I'll be able to see you guys, and then I can see you guys. Okay. When we look at a compound, so this is NMR spin-spin coupling. When we look at a compound that has two different protons in it, and those two protons are neighbors to each other. So I just want to have two protons. I'm going to put some other things in here so that I have a molecule that only has two hydrogens in it. These two protons are one slightly wider bond. One, two, three. They're three bonds apart. This is what's called a J3. These two protons influence each other as neighbors. And the influencing as neighbors, the way they influence each other is kind of unique. So if we were to look at HA by itself, and we take HA by itself, what winds up happening is HA has a spin state. This looks like an electron, but again, you have to remember that this is the nucleus, not an electron that we're dealing with. And we apply the magnetic field that splits the spin states, and we get a low energy spin state and a high energy spin state. So we can say that this is HA and HA in its excited state. And we get in line with the field and tilted precessing and a difference in energy. That difference in energy is proportional to the magnetic field. And what we get is on the spectrum where we list parts per million, we get a line, and that line represents the difference in energy from the zero point based on how strong the magnetic field is. So that's normal. That's what we normally see when HA is by itself. But when we put HA and HB next to each other, then we get a different situation. So now what happens is HA is affected by HB, They are near neighbors. And as near neighbors, if we look at HA, let me make sure that I have enough room to fit everything in here. So I'm going to tighten up everything just a bit so it all fits on one page. Okay. If we consider the two different spin states, the two different possibilities, what we consider is where both of the spin states are in their ground state. Or we consider a situation where HB could be in its excited state. And so what winds up happening is, when we consider HA and the spin state of HA, and this time what I'll do is I'll draw the spin states above it just to make it a little bit easier. There's two different possible situations that wind up occurring. We have the magnetic field, and we have the spin state of HB. And let's say that HB here in this case is in its excited state. And let's say that it's actually opposing the field. So we'll draw, instead of drawing it precessing, let's actually draw it flipped to indicate that it's in its excited state. And what happens there is that I get a B effective, an effective magnetic field, which is smaller. That effective magnetic field is smaller because the two spin states, the spin state of, or I should say the magnetic field itself and the spin state and the magnetic field caused by HB, they're opposite to each other and they subtract to each other and they make a small effective magnetic field. As the magnetic field gets small, the difference in energy between the spin states for HB gets small, or for HA gets small. So here's HA that's in its excited state and HA that's in its ground state. And the difference in energy between these two is a small difference in energy. We'll call it delta E1. And it's small. On the opposite side, we get that magnetic field. Plus we get HB, but in this case, HB is aligned with the field. And as they add together, they make a larger effective magnetic field. And as that's large, the difference in energy between the excited state and the ground state is large. And so we'll call this delta E2. And when we put these onto the spectrum, and we look at the parts per million, this is our zero mark, and parts per million. This was our original signal that corresponded to the change in energy here that was the normal change in energy. But what winds up happening is there's a shift that is off to the right, delta E one, which gives me a line spectrum here, and a shift off to the left downfield, delta E2. And what I wind up getting is I wind up getting two peaks rather than one. And this is what we call a doublet. And so what we see is that a near neighbor causes micro changes to the magnetic field. Those micro changes are subtraction from the magnetic field, addition to the magnetic field. They create a small energy difference and a large energy difference from the normal that we would expect to see. And that causes two possibilities to occur, one that is deshielded and one that is shielded. And that causes a splitting pattern that is a predictable splitting pattern. All right, are you guys with me so far? Is this making sense in terms of?
I had a question or a couple questions. So first off, does it only affect close protons, and what I forgot my second question.
It does affect close protons, and the effect falls off with distance. So what we see is that this effect with three bonds apart is sort of the standard, what we call coupling constant, and is some of the strongest interaction, three bonds apart. As you go to four and five bonds apart, the interaction falls off. Still visible, and depending upon your magnetic field, depending upon if you're using one of those really big NMR instruments, very expensive NMR instrument, then you can see all of these little splittings from three bonds, four bonds, and even five bonds apart. But on most NMRs, on like a 250, we're generally looking at J3s.
So is two bonds apart not as much of a problem?
That's a great question. When we look at two bonds apart, the type of things that we're looking at two bonds apart is, let's say that we have a double bond like this, and then this would be a J2. We can see a J2 as long as they're in different chemical environments. What happens is if the protons are in the same chemical environment, they don't split each other. So if I have R prime and R, then these guys will split and will couple with each other. And what I'll wind up getting is I'll wind up getting a doublet and a doublet, and that they will couple to each other, and one will be HA and one will be HB. But if I take and I make them both R groups so that these two protons are now chemically equivalent, chemically equivalent protons don't split each other. So it's about both distance and chemical equivalence, that chemically equivalent protons do not split each other. So when I have something that is a methyl group, and these three protons are all chemically equivalent, they don't split each other. They may have neighbors that may split them, but they won't split each other because they are all HAs. And chemically equivalent protons don't split each other. That's a really good question. Why don't they split each other? And I think it's because they're indistinguishable from one another. And in that they are indistinguishable, when we're showing the different possibilities of HA and HB being in different spin states, When the protons are chemically equivalent and indistinguishable, the spin states are indistinguishable from one another and they all collapse. But because these have different chemical shifts with HA and HB, they are chemically different. Their spin states do affect each other. And so what we see is we see that chemically equivalent protons will not split each other, whereas chemically different protons will. And it is about distance. So the closer they are, generally, the higher the coupling constant, the bigger the difference in energy.
I had another question. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the parts per million was based on the magnetic field strength or proportional to. Is that related to the how many megahertz the NMR machine is?
Yeah, let me clarify that. That's a good question. I think that I slightly misspoke when I said that the parts per million, I may have said, was related to the magnetic field. Actually, the parts per million is not related to the magnetic field. The parts per million, because of the way that it's calculated, is independent of magnetic field. What is proportional to the magnetic field is the distance between the doublet and how big the doublet is. The coupling constant becomes larger with a larger magnetic field. But the parts per million in the way that we calculate it, because it's calculated as a parts per million difference based on the reference and the signal, that when you change magnetic field from a 90 megahertz magnet to a 250, to a 350, to a 500, or even to a gigahertz, the actual shift that you will observe will be identical across all magnetic fields. What's different is the resolution and the ability to be able to see the difference between these doublets, the change in energy that is associated with the magnetic field that happens here in these splittings. That's what becomes different. Okay.
So for is the 14 parts per million, is that like the absolute maximum that we ever see for any hydrogen?
It can go above 14. Usually we don't see any protons that go above 14, but if you get really, really deshielded protons, I mean, like carboxylic acids, when we look at something that is really deshielded, we think about some of the most acidic protons that we know of. A carboxylic acid proton, which has a massive partial positive because you have pulled out a lot of electron density out of this thing. So this is a really acidic proton. These usually come somewhere around 11 to 12, or I would even say 11 to 14 parts per million. Now, can we create a stronger acid? Can we create an acid where a proton is even more acidic than a carboxylic acid? Yes. There's many different types of protons that we can create that are more acidic than carboxylic acids. pKa here, remember, is only 4.5. But we have acids where we go hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid, where their pKa's are down in the negatives, so their protons are more acidic. Yes, those protons can probably come beyond 14. But for organic molecules, it's rare to have an organic molecule where the proton falls outside of that range and farther downfield than 14. Just because the acidity of those carboxylic acids, the acidity that we see within organic molecules, does not generally fall that far. I think an exception might be sulfonates. These are things that are like sulfuric acid. Paratoluyl sulfonic acid, that proton, I'm not sure, I'd have to look it up, but I bet you it's close to 14 because of how acidic it is. It's more acidic than a carboxylic acid. So it's about deshielding. It's about how much of the electron density has been stripped out of the proton as to how far down you'll see that proton go.
I have a quick question about the earlier stuff.
Yeah, go.
So I'm trying to wrap my head around, we've been talking a lot about shielding and deshielding. Mm-hmm. And could you kind of tell me how making the magnetic effective smaller is deshielding or shielding.
So when we talk about shielding and we talk about deshielding, if we look at the PPM scale and we look at zero, we say that this is TMS. This is a proton that is attached to a methyl that has silicon. And so there's four other methyl groups on this. And this guy is an electron donating group. And it's pumping electron density towards this guy. And so the hydrogen that is sitting here, what we'd say is that this hydrogen has a large amount of electron density around it. And that electron density that is around it is shielding it. And so what's happening here at this point is that this electron density that is around it is taking the magnetic field, which may be of a particular strength. We'll use a vector and the size of the vector to be able to represent that. And the electrons are opposing that. And as the electrons oppose that, we add those two fields together. And what we get is an effective field that is small. If we take the opposite end of the spectrum and we look at a carboxylic acid, and we understand that now what's happening is that this is acting as an electron withdrawing group. And as an electron withdrawing group, this has an immense partial positive. And so what has happened here is that the electron density that is around this proton is very small. And being small, if we look at the signal that comes from this, if we take the same sort of concept that we had here, so that we have everything be the same, except what has happened is that this vector is now really tiny. And what that means is that the vector that is this guy is almost the full size. It's much larger. And what that does is that then makes the difference in energy. If we go back to this graph, and we say that in this direction, this is increasing B effective. This is the difference in energy that we're seeing between protons. And so each one of these can be read to be a difference in energy that is essentially equal to the parts per million. And so what we're seeing is that when the B effective is really small, as it is here, the difference in energy between the excited state and the ground state is very small. And I get a very small parts per million number. And as the B effective gets stronger, the difference between the excited state and the ground state gets bigger. And as that happens, the parts per million gets bigger. So this is what we call down here deshielded. And up in this range, we call it shielded. And so we get signals that will show up way down far for that guy, and a signal for tetramethylsilane, which will show up on the right-hand side. Does that help a little bit more?
Yeah, I think it'll get better with like application, but yes, that clears a little bit of it up.
Yeah, with application, what winds up happening is we don't even go back to this. I mean, we will use the shielded terms and the deshielded terms. I will use the language downfield and upfield. So this is downfield. This is upfield. And I'll use those terms in that language, but really, we're not going to be trying to calculate these. We're just going to be recognizing where things are and what it means in terms of where a proton signal is. I mean, what we need to recognize is that down this way, the farther down a proton is, the stronger the electron withdrawing group. And up in this direction, it's not that we necessarily get electron donating groups, but we get farther away, more distance away, or no electron withdrawing groups, either no electron withdrawing groups or farther away from the electron withdrawing groups. And so that's basically what we're seeing with the spectrum. And if I go and I grab a table, and I'm trying to think of where I've got, let me fish for a second. Actually, it'd be faster if I do this in a web browser and go through my old lectures for a second and find where I did NMR last semester. So I go archive from 2020. November 18th. I'm looking to see if I can find where I've got a good NMR table that I had brought in. So I can copy it and bring it in for you guys. Now it's going to be where we did problems all together. No, can't find it. Okay, I'm just going to get a new one for you. And hopefully I find a good one. The best NMR tables I find are ones that are not overly complicated and ones that you have in Pavia. Within the Pavia lab book, there are some really good NMR tables. That will work. This is very similar to the one that you have in Pavia. Okay, so here's an NMR table. And it gives you here the parts per million and the different functional groups and the ranges in which we can find those different functional groups. So this one only goes up to 12. Like I said, sometimes I like to include up to 14 to include other types of protons that can come in those ranges. And what we see is that methyl groups, methylenes, and formal groups, these guys all show up at a range which is 0 to 2. And then we get into a range here where we have protons that are like alkynes, or a proton that is alpha to a carbonyl, or a proton which is alpha to a double bond, protons which are on carbons that have nitrogens on them, or carbons that have sulfurs on them, or even benzylic protons. All of these show up in this range. NHs and OHs have a very, very wide range in which they show up. Halogens and oxygens, which are more electron withdrawing, wind up pulling farther downfield. We can see protons that are on a carbon-carbon double bond. They have a fairly wide range. These are phenols and aniline protons. They have a fairly wide range. We get to aromatics, and then aldehydes and carboxylic acids. And so this gives you a fairly good idea of the range in which different protons can show up. And it's not all entirely electron withdrawing groups, because we would expect that a proton that is on an aromatic ring would not be so far downfield, or certainly not any more downfield than a proton that would be on a carbon-carbon double bond. And electron withdrawing wise, when we look at an alkyne, we would expect that based on this sp hybridization, that this would be way more electron withdrawing than an sp2 hybridized proton, and yet this proton is more upfield. And so there's some funky things that are going on in here where it's not just electron withdrawing groups that are causing the chemical shift of the proton. There's more going on than that. And so what we can look at is a couple of different unique situations. For instance, in an aromatic ring system, if we take and we draw an aromatic ring system in a flat planar sort of orientation, what we find is that the pi electrons that are in this system, these pi electrons create a ring current of electrons that when they are placed in the magnetic field, what winds up happening is in the magnetic field, a current gets set up. And that current is current lines that actually do something a little bit different. Let me try and do it this way. Trying to get the drawing thing to do what you want it to do all the time. Sometimes challenging. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to partially erase it sets up a ring current. And what happens in the ring current is based on the flow of the field. What winds up happening is that as the field comes this direction and passes past the proton, it deshields the proton. The ring current winds up as it comes out in here, and where this proton actually sits, winds up deshielding this proton, because the ring current that gets sets up winds up opposing the magnetic field. And I think I may have actually just done it in reverse. I think the arrows need to go the other way in order to actually reverse the field. So if I'm looking at the field being this way, then these ring currents kind of set up this way. And these ring currents wind up opposing the B field. Plus strong ring current. And that winds up making a smaller B effective. And so what happens is this guy in here gets deshielded. So aromatic protons fall way downfield, farther downfield than we would expect, not because of an electron withdrawing group, because of a ring current that winds up getting set up in them. And if we look at alkynes, alkynes are kind of unique too, in that alkynes also have these pi electrons that stick forward and backwards that make the pi bonds in this guy. In this guy, what winds up happening is the ring current gets set up like this. And in this case, what winds up happening is the proton winds up actually getting shielded rather than deshielded. It winds up in an area where the magnetic field is actually stronger. And so what winds up happening here is we get the magnetic field and we get a ring current, which is in line with the magnetic field, which makes a larger than expected, I switched it all entirely. My whole argument, and I had it right the first time, and then I convinced myself I was doing it wrong. If this guy is deshielded, then in order to be deshielded, it needs to have a reinforcement. It is a strong ring current, but it is a reinforcement in the ring current. I was just going totally backwards. And that moves things downfield and deshields it. And this one is the one that's reversed. And we wind up getting a smaller B effective and it moves it upfield. So what winds up happening is that we see when we look at these guys, the proton, which is here, is downfield due to ring currents with the ring that caused this to be deshielded. And the proton, which is here, which is on an alkyne, is upfield more than it should be because the ring currents that happen with this carbon-carbon triple bond wind up actually shielding this proton. And so it's the double bonds, the alkenes and the alkynes, it's the unsubstituted molecules where we can get some ring currents with those double bonds and triple bonds that wind up shielding and deshielding in funny ways that we wouldn't normally expect. So it's not entirely up to electronegativity. It's also some quantum effects with the double bonds and the triple bonds and the magnetic field that they're being placed into that causes ring currents that can shield and deshield as well. And so what's nice though is that we can create a table of the parts per million and the chemical shift that we expect. And these tables can be super detailed. Many of these tables are more detailed than we need. I like to go with a simple table rather than a super detailed table, especially when starting, because what you find is that, let's say that I have a signal that shows up in this range and I get a signal at 3.5 and I want to know what that signal is. Well, that signal could be any of the things that show up in the boxes that it crosses. So it could be an NH or an OH. It could be an OH or NH that is not on an aromatic ring. It could be a proton which is next to a halogen or next to a methoxy group or ether. And so the hard part is knowing, when I get a proton that shows up in this range, what is it? The more detailed your table, the more boxes of functional groups that you run across, and the harder it becomes to interpret, because you're looking at it and you're trying to decide, well, which one of these is it? And there's so many that overlap, it becomes more difficult. In the beginning, I like to go with simpler tables with less boxes so that you're not overwhelmed by decision-making processes and that the decision-making process becomes easier, if that makes sense. So anyway, this is a table that is equivalent to the ones that are in the back of your lab book, in the back of Pavia. And they have both a carbon and a proton table. And those are the two tables that I recommend. This one is almost identical to the one in Pavia. In fact, it could very well be the one in Pavia. So those are good tables to wind up using. All right. So we're talking about the spin-spin coupling. The spin-spin coupling follows what's called an N plus one rule. Where N is the number of neighbors. So basically what we look at is that we see that if we have the number of neighbors, and the splitting, the number of lines that will result is that if we have zero neighbors, we get one signal. If we have one neighbor, we get two signals, two splittings. If we have two neighbors, three splittings, three neighbors, four splittings, and so on. It's just following an N plus one rule. So you take the number of neighbors and you add one to it, and that tells you how many signals you get. But the interesting part is, what do those signals look like? The signals have different intensity patterns. So essentially, they follow Pascal's triangle in terms of their intensity patterns. Pascal's triangle is a mathematical pattern where I take the line above, and basically what I do is I add the two numbers together in the line above. To create the next pattern. And so the next pattern here would be a 1 to 4 to 6 to 4 to 1. And after that, it would be a 1 to 5 to 10 to 10 to 5 to 1. This is Pascal's triangle. And it protects, or excuse me, it predicts the intensities of the signals that I expect to see for the different types of splitting patterns. In other words, if I look at the intensities, this is a 1-to-1 intensity, and this is what I call a doublet. Two lines of equal intensity, a 1-to-2-to-1 is what I call a triplet. And its intensities are 1-to-2-to-1. The 1-to-3-to-3-to-1 is what I call a quartet. And it has intensities of 1-to-3-to-3-to-1 in terms of its splitting patterns. The 1-to-4-to-6-to-4-to-1 is a pentet. And the patterns keep going. So the next step from the pentet would be the sextet. And the patterns must have these intensities or they don't match the pattern. If they have different intensities than this, then the pattern is not correct. How do I show this to you? Let me show you the patterns. Let me stop this screen share. Let me grab a different application and screen share it once I get it up and running. This is a little Java applet. It is called JVisualizer. And let's see if I can share this. Okay, with JVisualizer, what I can do is I can take a signal, such as we're seeing here on the screen, and I can give it a neighbor. And in giving it a neighbor, I can create a doublet. And the size of the doublet, the distance between the peaks, is what's called the J value. The J value is determined by how strongly they magnetically couple. The J value is telling me about how strong the interaction between the two protons are. The stronger the interaction, the bigger the distance between the two peaks. And that's what's called the J value. If I want to give it another neighbor, I can give it another neighbor in a multiple ways. I can sit here and I can click triplet, and then I can increase the coupling. And you can see the pattern that it went from 1-to-1 to now 1-to-2-to-1. And that triplet can have different J values. It can be a very narrow triplet, very close together, or very far apart. To see a quartet, well, now we can see the 1-to-3-to-3-to-1 in terms of the quartet. And if it has a pattern that is different than this, then it's not a quartet. So a quartet needs to be 1-to-3-to-3-to-1. Or if those ratios are something different than that, then it's not a quartet. Now, what do I mean ratios being something different? Well, let me go ahead and pick a triplet, and then let me give it a doublet, and let me let the lines bump into each other. And you can see that I can create a pattern here which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 peaks. And this is 1 to 2 to 2 to 2 to 1. There is no pattern that is a simple pattern that is a 1 to 2 to 2 to 2 to 1. It's a pattern that was created by multiple coupling constants landing on top of each other in just the right way in order to create a unique situation. And so what we have are simple couplings and complicated couplings. We'll start by learning to read the simple couplings, and then we'll branch out learning to read complicated couplings. For instance, there can be things that are doublets, and then I can get a double doublet, 4 peaks of the same intensity. I can get triplets, and then I can get a double triplet, which can change the peak intensities. I can get triple triplets, where the peak intensities are really obscure, really crazy. And so all of these things become possible within the NMR, and we're going to need to learn how to read many of these. So one of the ways, let me stop that share, let me go back to sharing my screen. How do I know what a pattern is going to look like? How do I predict these patterns? Let's take a molecule that has it has 2 different types of protons, A and B. And let's look at what we expect coupling-wise for A and coupling-wise for B. The way that I do this is with a tree diagram. What I do, and sometimes it's easier to use a grid in order to do this, what I do is I look at HA and I draw a line that represents the parts per million signal for HA. And then I draw lines that represent the splitting that happens by HB. However, there's not just one HB. There's 3 of them. And so the first HB creates a splitting in this signal, splits the first HB splits HA into a doublet, but then the second HB splits it again and it splits it by the exact same amount, such that what winds up happening is these 2 lines, as they come back into the center, add together and they make an intensity of 2. And so I'm using the 2 lines to represent the intensity of 2 that these 2 lines add back together. Essentially what there is there's 2 ways to get this line. And because there's 2 ways to get this line, its relative intensity becomes twice that of these lines out here, of which there's only 1 way to get that line. And then it happens again with the third HB. And so each one of these guys gets split by the exact same amount. And I get an intensity 1 and 1 out there. I get 1, 2, 3 because 3 lines came together. And I get 1, 2, 3 because 3 lines came together. And so what I get here is I get a line that is 3 times the height of these guys out here. And this would be the signal that I expect. This would be the signal for HA. HA is 1 proton being represented with intensities that are 1, to 3 to 3 to 1. And when I integrate this and I take and I measure the area underneath these, because what this actually is this actually represents little curves. And when I integrate this, it integrates and it integrates for one proton. And it has ratios of 1 to 3 to 3 to 1. And this is what we call a quartet. And that quartet implies that it has three neighbors. So that's the signal that happened from HA. What happened with HB? Let's take a look at HB and see what happened to HB. And in fact, let's take all of this and slide all this over. And we'll put HB right next to it. What happened to HB was much the same thing. Here's the line for HB. HB has one neighbor. That neighbor is HA. This is the only splitting that happens. The intensities are 1 to 1. And so the signal that happens for HB is a signal that is a doublet, 1 to 1. And so if I look at this, the line comes up and is a curve. The ratios are 1 to 1. And the integration value, if I were to integrate it, would integrate at 3. And so the integration line would literally be 3 times the size of the other one. And this would be a doublet that would equal one neighbor. And the distance that is here is called the J value. And that distance and this distance have to be the same, because these two protons split each other, and because these two protons split each other, the J value would equal a specific value. We'll call it JAB. And that JAB will be consistent and will show up. JAB will show up in the distance here. It'll show up here. It'll show up here. And it'll show up here. And it will be identical because these protons are splitting each other. And that's how we know that these protons are splitting each other, because the J value, the distance between all these peaks, is exactly identical. If the J value, if the distance between these two peaks and any of these four are different, then these two are not neighbors and they are not splitting each other. Maybe you can see now why I think this is a good idea to do this sort of redundantly, do it in lab and do it in lecture and be able to hit it multiple times, because it's complicated. In the way that these things go together. And it's going to get easier with practice. It's going to get easier as we go through and we start to use it and reconstruct molecules. But yeah, it's a little bit complicated in the way that they interact and go together. And so when we take a proton and we take a molecule and we look at a molecule. Let me get rid of the paper for a second. Go back to blank. When we look at a molecule, I can even just do it right here. We can have a prediction now that we can say that these guys are going to couple to each other. They're neighbors. It's a J3, meaning that it's three bonds apart. And that these guys are going to couple. The prediction is that this one would be a quartet with ratios of 1 to 3 to 1. And it's going to integrate for one proton. And these guys out here, these are going to be a doublet. They're going to have ratios of 1 to 1, and they're going to integrate for 3. And we can even predict which ones would be farther downfield. Which ones do you think would be farther downfield, HA or HB? Which one is attached to the stronger electron withdrawing group? A, yeah, exactly. And so if we had a scale, parts per million, that was set up, and this is our zero mark, what we would expect is that that aldehyde proton would be way downfield. And this would be our doublet. So this would be HA. And then the other one is going to be over here and is going to be a 1 to 3 to 3 to 1. Nope, I just did that wrong. I need a little quartet. And then I need a big doublet. And this will be HB. And these will integrate for values of 1 to 3. And we're looking at ratios of 1 to 3 to 3 to 1 and 1 to 1. And those are our different protons.
Could you go back to explaining like why that makes it a doublet, or why the HBs are a doublet versus HA being a quartet?
The Y comes out to this tree diagram. When we look at HA, HA gets split by the first HB. When HA gets split by the first HB, it creates a doublet. But then each of those doublet lines, when they're next to the next HB, each of those doublet lines winds up getting split into another doublet. Let me try and give you a different picture and show you kind of what's happening. Okay, let's say that this signal right here is HA. I'm going to split it into a doublet, and I'm going to split it into a doublet with a J value that is, let's call it 0.5. This is the first HB that split this into a doublet. Now I'm going to split it with a second HB. So each line gets broken into a doublet. So see my little doublets? And as I increase those intensities to the 0.5 mark, the exact same value as the first one, boom, the lines cross over and they add together in the center. And so the two intensities that are in the center add together to make an intensity 2. Now I'm going to split it by a third proton. This is the third HB. It takes all these lines and I split it into the exact same coupling constant, And as I get to that exact same coupling constant, the lines overlap and the intensities add, and I get intensities of 1 to 3 to 3 to 1. If I back it off a little bit, you can see that what I'm adding is I'm adding intensity 2 to intensity 1. That's going to create intensity 3. And it's going to do the same right here as soon as they cross over. And so it comes from a way of looking at probability. Let me do it. Maybe I could do it a different way yet. It's all about finding multiple ways to show and explain. Okay, so I just showed you with the app that creates J values. I've shown it to you with a tree diagram. Let me show it to you from its origin of where it actually originates from. How do we know this? And I think instead of a 4-spin system, let's go to a 3-spin system. Let's take one of the protons out. I'll use a chlorine to take one of the protons out. So now I've just got a 3-spin system. And let's just track HA. All right, so all I want to do is look at HA. If I look at the different possibilities, one of the possibilities is that HA, whose spin state I am interested in, and the two HBs, let's say I want to look at the highest energy possibility where the two HBs are, let me see the way that I did it back up here, make sure that I'm consistent so I don't mess this up. Yeah. What I want to do is I want each one of these spin states to be in their ground state, not in their excited state. That means that B effective is going to be adding up these two plus the magnetic field. And what I get is I get a very large B effective. And I get a very large difference in the HA proton. On the small side, on the opposite end of the spectrum, what I can envision happening is I want to look at HA. And I got each of the HBs. And each of the HBs are in their excited states. In their excited states, B effective now is reduced dramatically. And as that's reduced dramatically, I get a very small difference in energies between HA. Okay, and then what we can imagine happening in the middle is two different possibilities, which cannot be distinguished from each other. One possibility is that the first HB is in its ground state and the second HB is in its excited state. And in the second one, we can assume that the first HB is in its excited state and the second HB is in its ground state. What's happening here is that these two are essentially canceling each other out. And because they're canceling each other out, the effective is sort of unchanged. And there's two times this possibility, which is sort of like the normal B field. And so I have something which is neither added to or subtracted from. I just have the normal B field. And so this is HA, which is in its excited state. And HA in its ground state. And we would say that this is normal, but times two in intensity. And so what winds up happening is we get a line pattern times two in its intensity, subtract to the small one, add to the large one, and we wind up getting what's called the triplet. And they have ratios of 1 to 2 to 1, which is the possibility, one way of forming this, two ways of forming this, one way of forming that. How did I do?
That helps like an unbelievable amount. A lot of things up.
Cool. I'm glad that worked. Yeah, not easy to explain some of these things. It just takes a little bit of time to sit down and to actually draw them out. Okay, the same thing winds up happening when we get quartets and pentets. And that's why I use these patterns. This is meant to simulate the number of times that I get these patterns. And so the lines, as the lines overlap, they add. And the number of lines represents the intensity in the pattern. It's just an easier way to predict this, if that makes sense. And so I prefer to go with the tree diagrams as much as possible to be able to explain the different intensities than trying to go through and draw them all out. Okay. I think that's as much as I want to do this morning. I think, because we're going to do this, this is going to be pretty redundant, in fact, with lecture. And in fact, we may get the same questions again, which is not going to be a bad thing. Like I said, redundancy in going through these things and understanding them is important. What we'll get in lecture in addition to this is hopefully I'll give you some examples and I'll pull up some spectrum and we'll look at these patterns. And we'll start to get into how do we actually break down these patterns and some examples of how do we go through and solve the problems. And then I'll show you a great website for practice problems as well. Okay. So I think that's where I want to go. Unless there's any questions, I think that's as much as I want to do this morning. And we'll come back and we'll meet at 12:40 for lecture. How's that sound? Cool. And remember, it's not going to become easier or better understanding until we start getting into the application. It's the practice of it. It's the repetition of it and the practice of it and the using it that is actually going to make it stick. So right now it's going to be fuzzy, and that's why repetition is good while it's fuzzy. And then we'll get into the application and that'll start to solidify it when you start to actually start using it in practice. And it'll get a whole lot easier at that point. All right, I'll stay on the line if there's any questions. And other than that, I will see you guys at 12:40.